Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. So this evening we're reading from the seventh chapter of Bhagavad Gita, as it is, which is entitled Knowledge of the Absolute. And this evening we're looking at the second verse. This verse is on the board behind me. Please repeat line by line. Jnanam teham sabhijnanam. Idam vikshami sheshatah. Yad gyapa neha bhavo nyaj. Gyatavyam avishishyate. Jnanam. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Bhaktivedanta Swami. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. I shall now declare unto you in full this knowledge, both phenomenal and numinous. This being known, nothing further shall remain for you to know. Purport. Complete knowledge includes knowledge of the phenomenal world, the spirit behind it, and the source of them both. This is transcendental knowledge. The Lord wants to explain the above-mentioned system of knowledge because Arjuna is Krishna's confidential devotee and friend. In the beginning of the fourth chapter, this explanation was given by the Lord, and it is again confirmed here. Complete knowledge can be achieved only by the devotee of the Lord in disciplic succession directly from the Lord. Therefore, one should be intelligent enough to know the source of all knowledge, who is the cause of all causes, and the only object for meditation in all types of yoga practice. When the cause of all causes becomes known, then everything knowable becomes known, and nothing remains unknown. The Vedas, Mundaka Upanishad 1.3, say, Kasmin Bhagavo Bigyate Sarvam Idam Bigyatam Bhavati. Again, this verse reads, Gyanam Te Haham Subigyanam Idam Bhakshami Asheshataha Yajgetva Neha Buyo Nyaj Gyatavyam Avishishate. Please repeat the translation after me. I shall now declare unto you,
I shall now declare unto you,
in full this knowledge,
in full this knowledge,
both phenomenal and numinous,
both phenomenal and numinous,
this being known,
this being known,
nothing further shall remain for you to know.
Mukam karoti bachilam mangam langayate garim yutkripataram
mande Sri Gurun Dinataranyam. This verse is very, very significant. One significance is that when Srila Prabhupada brought into being the Bhaktivedanta Institute, this is ISKCON's Science Institute, which is still doing work, particularly in India. His Holiness Swarup Damodar Goswami Maharaj holds worldwide programs in the name of this Bhaktivedanta Institute. Also, His Grace Rasaraj Prabhu in Mumbai is doing scientific preaching under the banner of Bhaktivedanta Institute. And His Grace Drutakarma Prabhu, who I believe has been here, has also produced several important books, but The Forbidden Archaeology, which he wrote together with Sadabhuta Prabhu, has had world-shaking impact in the field of evolution, paleontology, that sort of area. So when Srila Prabhupada brought this Bhaktivedanta Institute into being, he proposed that there be a journal, and that journal is indeed still being produced by His Holiness Swarup Damodar Maharaj, and he wanted the name of that journal to be Sabhigyanam, which is taken from this verse. So, Sabhigyanam, as Srila Prabhupada translates here, means with numinous knowledge. Now, we need to explain these terms because these are, you know, $10 words. Phenomenal knowledge and numinous knowledge. You may not be familiar with these terms. So first of all, phenomenal knowledge, like the word phenomena. When we speak of phenomena, then we are speaking of, generally it's often connected with something extraordinary, some extraordinary, but nonetheless passing event in this material world. like if something was very awe-inspiring, something happened that was very thrilling, then someone might say, oh, it was phenomenal. But he's talking about something that has come and gone. This is the point. Yes, it may have been very impressive, but because it is phenomenal, now we are talking about it in past tense. And actually, person, he socially can gain points among his comrades, among his friends, if he was there to actually see some wonderful event and they were not there. And then he can go, oh, it was phenomenal. Too bad you weren't there, but I saw it. You see? They can't see it. Why? Because it's gone. So this is, in other words, material event. The events of this temporary material world. They're classified all, whether extraordinary or very ordinary, all can be placed under this heading of phenomenal, passing away with time. And opposed to this is numinous knowledge. Now, I believe that this word numinous comes from Greek root in Platonic philosophy. Plato taught of this nous, he called it. And I think that is where this word is coming from. Numinous, the nous. The nous means the realm of superior intelligence. Or some idea of a spiritual realization. And there is a realm, a higher realm, which he called the realm of ideas. And so when one cultivates this, what he, in his philosophical system, termed nous, then we can access this realm of eternal and perfect ideas. So this is something that is, in broad strokes, it has many remarkable similarities to our Gaudiya Vaishnava philosophy, in broad strokes. When you get into specifics, then Platonic philosophy also starts to fall apart. Because after all, Plato, Socrates, they were also speculators. But apparently they started off with some Vedic ingredients. There are some historical indicators to that. So the basic form of Platonic philosophy is that we have this world, which is a mere reflection. In other words, again, phenomena, a phenomenal reflection of a pure realm of eternal ideas, he called them. Now, but his use of this word idea is not the same as the way we use it today. Idea just means some notion you get in your head. Oh, I have an idea, why don't we? But he was referring to forms, pure thought forms that are manifest in this nous, a kind of eternal mindscape. And so by proper reason, as Plato explained, according to his philosophy, then one can penetrate this mindscape of pure thought forms. And one will see there, as he explained, that, for example, here we have flowers, but flowers are very temporary, very phenomenal things. You know, we bring flowers to offer to the deity, but they have to be taken away after a day. Actually, that is by Prabhupada's order. In Vrindavan, Srila Prabhupada, because Prabhupada, especially in Vrindavan, would inspect everything. And devotees quickly came to know that, you know, if you've done something provisional, something that's not up to standard, but provisional, because you're not able to get everything together as it should be, so you're thinking, well, just for a day or two, we'll do it this way. But Prabhupada would find out about it. He would always, like as if he had radar, any, even well-intentioned compromise, Prabhupada would seek it out and find it. So once he happened to look into the deity room, and he saw baskets of flowers that were to be offered to the deity, and he said, "What are these?" And the Maharaj in charge at the time said, "Oh, these are flowers for the deity." And Srila Prabhupada said, "But they're old. They're all already wilting." And the Maharaj said, "But Srila Prabhupada, you know, it takes a while to pick them, so we pick them the day before. And then we offer them the next morning." And Prabhupada said, "No, they must be picked on the same day and offered the same day." So, flowers are a very perishable thing once they're picked. Very phenomenal. They're beautiful, sweet-smelling, very nice creations of Lord Krishna, but very phenomenal. But in Platonic philosophy, he proposed that in this nous, mindscape, there is the eternal idea form of a flower. And it is perfectly real and unchanging and reflected in this world. So, you see, this is a very, very important pillar of our Gaudiya Vaishnava Vedanta philosophy. So this is where we get these words from in this verse. Prabhupada selected. Prabhupada, when he did his translations, he selected, it was amazing with what care and attention he selected words by which he rendered Sanskrit terminology into English. So this is a very apt example of that, his use of the words phenomenal and numinous. And then, yes, jnanam, teham sabhijnanam. So jnanam, the word jnanam, in other words, this refers to knowledge of this material world. The phenomena of this material world. So, Prabhupada wanted the Bhaktivedanta Institute, a journal, to be called Sabhijnanam, because science is about this phenomenal knowledge. But Prabhupada wanted his scientists, his Bhaktivedanta scientists, to present that phenomenal knowledge together with the numinous or transcendental knowledge. And this way the presentation would be complete. So here in this verse then, jnan, it means Hare Krishna, knowledge of this phenomenal world, and that in itself. You see, the jnanis, what are they doing? The jnanis are attempting to transcend this world with this type of knowledge, phenomenal knowledge. And how do they attempt to do that? By a process known as neti-neti. Neti-neti means not this, not this. It's a negative sort of logic. They are intending to arrive at Brahman, the absolute truth, but they're only able to define this Brahman in negative terms. By studying this material world and concluding that this is not Brahman. This is not Brahman because it is temporary, it is phenomenal, and Brahman is eternal. So, in other words, this jnana process is a kind of philosophical fault finding. It's a study of the world, a very careful study of the world, but to find faults with it, to point out its defects, its shortcomings, so that intellectually they can reject it. And they're hoping by this rejection, by this negation, after they've studied everything, there's nothing left, you see? Everything has been examined by them and rejected as being phenomenal, material, temporary, imperfect. Then they will arrive at the Brahman state. But of course, this way of going about the identification, the identifying process of Brahman, it must be impersonal, you see? Because it's all based on negativity. You're looking at material forms and rejecting them as being limited and temporary. But you have no knowledge of bijnana, transcendental forms. So what will be your conclusion? That Brahman, the Absolute Truth, is formless. It has no name. It has no form. It has no activity. It has no qualities. There are no relationships within Brahman. Because name, form, quality, activities, relationships, we see them here in this world. And we have studied them and we have found that they are phenomenal, they are limited, they are temporary, they are full of suffering, they are full of ignorance, etc., etc., etc. You see? So this is only going halfway. In fact, those who become Mayavadis, who adopt this a doctrine that anything that has name, form, quality, activity, relationship must be Maya. Throwing the baby out with the bathwater. There's this example. You put a baby in bath water, in the bath, little bathtub. And of course the water becomes dirty. So you want to throw that out. You have to throw that out. You can't keep the dirty water. But if you don't remove the little child from the bathtub, then you throw out, you also do harm to the little child. So this analogy is very apt. Because name, form, quality, activity, relationship have to be, just like when you put baby in bathwater. Why do you do that? To purify the little thing. It's dirty. So you wash it to purify. So similarly, name, form, quality, activity, relationship must be purified, not simply rejected by some negative logic, pessimistic, fault-finding logic. They have to be purified. And the jnanis don't know how to do this. So this is the grave error in their process. And they hope to achieve liberation, but they actually do not. This is explained in a famous verse in Srimad Bhagavatam, in which the jnanis are said to be avishuddha buddhaya. Their intelligence remains impure. And the impurity of their intelligence is seen in this negationist process. It proves that they're less intelligent. There's another apt analogy the analogy of a cow. A cow has had the horrible experience of being trapped in a barn that caught fire. And the bright red, orange flames, shimmering flames, were getting closer and closer to the poor cow. And she was tied up in the barn and she was crying in horror, about to be burned up. But at last moment, the farmer broke in and untied her and led her out, the rope around the neck, led her out of the barn, saved her at the last moment. So this impression of the fire went deep, 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 deep into the cow's brain. So that later on, she was grazing in the pasture near the farmhouse, and the farmer's wife came out, and she was hanging out the sheets, bed sheets and curtains and so on. And these were all of orange and yellow color. And the wind was blowing, so these sheets began to flutter, orange and yellow fluttering. And the cow saw this and remembered the fire, also orange, yellow sheets. And she bellowed in terror and ran far away. And the farmer was having to go after her to bring her back. Now, you see, this is indicating impure or undeveloped intelligence. Yes, there is some resemblance. There is some resemblance between the shimmering sheets of fire, orange and yellow flames, and sheets of cloth, curtains and bed sheets and so on, dyed orange and yellow, which are fluttering in the breeze on the clothesline. There is some relationship, but if one is a careful observer, if one has discrimination, one will also understand there's a difference, and we have to be cautious with the flame, but there's nothing to be afraid of from cloth sheets on the clothesline. But what can you say? This is a cow. A cow is, of course, an animal, so the intellect is not developed. So the impersonalists, these jnanis, impersonalist jnanis, they're also following this go-nyaya, cow logic. They have experience of this material. Lord Buddha Dev, after he achieved his enlightenment, then his first lecture at a place called the Deer Park, it has gone down in history as the fire lecture. So this is a very, very apt presentation of this type of neti-neti philosophy, the fire lecture, where he was saying that everything, your eyes, your ears, your tongue, your nose, everything that you're experiencing, all phenomenal existence, is burning. It's fire. You see? Because of this, what we're experiencing here, we are undergoing birth and death, disease and old age. We are like trapped in a fire and being consumed by it. At every moment, time is robbing us of our life. So this fire lecture. Yes, so yes, we have definitely all experienced this fire of material existence. But then to conclude that anything, Krishna's pastimes, because they also exhibit name, form, quality, activity, relationships, that also must be fire. And we must also run away from that into the void or into nirakar brahman, nirvishesha brahman. This is go-nyaya. This is cow logic. So Bhagavatam says, these kind of philosophers, avishuddha buddhya, their intelligence is impure. Huh? And And they may think they have achieved liberation. But vimukti manina. Yes, it is only on the mental plane their liberation. And you know, Prahlad Maharaj warns about this. Mano vrattana sati davato bhi. Riding the chariot of the mind. He says this is a very, very insecure position. When your whole, spiritual life is depending upon simply a mental state, a mental conclusion. That's very, very dangerous, because the mind is notoriously, in Gita, Krishna says, it is chanchalam, it is flickering, it is astiram, it is unsteady. And yet you are trying to make that your solid ground in spiritual life. That, oh, I've had experience of this world, I know it's bad, so my mind has rejected it. So that means your mind is your guru. And one whose mind is one own guru has no guru. Because mind is not guru. Guru, besides meaning teacher, means heavy. And mind is not heavy. Mind is lagu. Mind is light. Mind is like a puff of smoke, which can be blown here and there by any breeze. Mind is so changing. Yes, so we may have had a bad experience of material existence, and we may feel, this is called Shmashana Vairagya. Shmashana means the crematorium, the burning ground. So if we, someone who is dear to us, if we have to see our wife or husband or son or someone who we held very dear to our heart, father, mother, anyone, if we have to attend their cremation, this gruesome cremation, see the body consumed into ashes, and at one point they even break the skull after the body is partially consumed. In the Orthodox Hindu funerals, they take a big stick and break open the skull. The idea is that the soul may still be clinging to that body, so break open the skull to free it. So this is in the West when they have a funeral, of course. You know, they put makeup on the body, make it look as nice as possible, dress it up in nice clothes, inject it with formaldehyde so it won't smell, and they keep it on display, open casket, and people come and they kiss and they cry, and you know, all that attachment remains, you see. And the body is put in the ground and they throw earth and flowers and all of that. But in India, everyone gets a chance to see what the body is really like. Now, Western people think it is so gruesome, and see, it's just a horrible thing. Of course, even in the West, there are some, like in one Greek devotee was telling me about traditional Greek Orthodox funerals. They also put the body in the ground, but then after 3 years, they dig it back up. And the whole family has to be there and watch the body be taken out of the ground. And then the priest, he takes the skull of that body and he pours wine into it and he holds it out. He says, if any of you family members feel that you offended this person and that offense was not rectified in the life of this person, and you still feel some, you know, guilt, heavy heart, because of you, some lingering problem between you and your father, whoever it is, grandfather, whoever it is, then you must drink the wine from this skull. This I was told. So, also in Europe, then there are some practices like that to teach us what is the. Of course, that's very tamasic. That sounds like the Vamamarg Tantra, left-handed Tantra path that the Shaivites follow. They also drink wine from skulls. Anyway, this is, but smarsana vairagya, this is the point. Because actually this Greek devotee was telling me that when he saw his father, after 3 years, dug up out of the ground, and then they put the, you know, they washed the bones in wine, and then they placed the bones under the church. And the family has to be there and watch that whole thing. He said it was so disturbing because he was just a boy of about 10 years old. And he had to see all that, and he was so disturbed. He said it psychologically shocked him very deeply. So smarsana vairagya, you see, if we have to attend, see the burning of a relative or something even more horrible like this Greek form of funeral ceremony, and then a sense of vairagya, renunciation or disgust towards the world will certainly come up. But it is, like we were telling in another class, quoting Rupa Goswami, it is palgu also. Palgu means the same thing, like I said. There's guru and there's lagu. Lagu means light. Palgu also means lightweight. It is lightweight renunciation. There's no guarantee it's going to last. And we have a very apt example in our modern Western culture. There are so many doctors, so many medical schools, so many people going to medical schools, learning all about this physical body. They have to perform as students. They learn about the body by, you know, they bring in fresh cadavers into the laboratory, fresh dead bodies. And they have to gather around and watch teacher take a scalpel and cut it open. And then he'll tell the students, now you remove the intestines. And they have to reach in and pull out all the intestines and put them to one side. And then he makes another incision. Now take out the heart and take out the lungs, take out the brain. And so so they have apt for years and years and years training of what this body is really all about. And then if they pass their internship and they become doctors, so that's their profession. Dealing with this body, performing operations. Anyway, they have every day they're confronted with the actual nature of the of the body. But do these doctors become sannyasis as a result? Do they give up sense gratification? Do they become renunciates, vairagis? No, not at all. In spite of knowing exactly what the body is, still they go on with their own sense gratification. Still they're also attracted to the form of the opposite sex. You see? I mean, it's actually mind-boggling, but that's how powerful Maya is. He can be a pathologist, right? And he's just, you know, they brought in a dead woman, a young woman who died somehow. And he has to perform the autopsy. So he cuts the body open. It's a very horrible thing. Cut the whole thing open, remove all the insides, take out the brain, photograph everything, make records, write it up, and come out, you know, take the gloves off, bloody gloves, and take off the apron, all blood all over. Just having seen the inside of a woman's body. Then he goes out and his wife is there and he gives her a big kiss. Hi, honey. This is the power of Maya. You see? So this type of gyan, to simply study this phenomenal world, does not actually place us in a solid position of transcendence, of being transcendental to the attraction of this body and material sense objects. And that we can see very, very clearly. So there must be sabbijnanam. It must be with transcendental knowledge, with knowledge of the origin of everything. And now another interesting point is Krishna says, Idam Bhakshami Asheshata. I'm going to explain this. He uses the word Vakshami. Asheshata in full. Shesh means end. Asheshata means endless. Well, Krishna is actually saying this knowledge is endless. That one goes on and on and on and on explaining it. It's an unlimited subject matter. Particularly when we're talking about the origin, the spiritual, transcendental, original name, form, quality, activity, relationship. Now, these jnanis, these impersonalist speculators, negationists, using their neti-neti process, not this, not this, and coming to a conclusion of shunya, or nirvishesha brahman. Now, it's interesting that in the Mayavadi philosophy, because you note this word, vakshami, the root is vak, vacha, like we have in English the word vocal or voice. So this is coming from the same root, vak, vacha, vocal, voice. So it means that which is spoken, that which is enunciated in words. So in Buddhism, which is totally negationist philosophy, as Prabhupada explains, the Buddhist meditation is a method of breaking everything down. They have also their own system of analyzing the material phenomena, which is loosely based on Sankhya philosophy. It's an adaptation of Sankhya philosophy. And so they break everything down until there's nothing but atoms, and then they remove the atoms, and then there's only what? Shunya, void. And that's the end. You see, that's their gati. That's their goal, to achieve this shunya. Therefore, Buddhism is called shunyavad. It is voidism. Voidism, this is an exact translation of shunyavad. So, in Buddhist philosophy, they have a term, abhyakritta, abhyakritta vastuni. Vastu means subject. You all heard this. Have heard this word, because vastu is. Does this boy want to come in or out? This is. Or does he just want to play with the door? It's hard to compete against these disturbances. Anyway, so. I'll just be quiet until all this stops. That's the only thing I can do. One thing or the other, either playtime or class time. We can't mix the two. So anyway, the Buddhists, they have this term, abhyakritta vastuni, that there are subjects. They count them as 10. 10 subjects which are abhyakrita. Krishna says, Vakshami, I will speak about jnanam teham sabhijnanam, knowledge both phenomenal and numinous. I will speak, and this is an unlimited subject matter, but the Buddhists, because of their negationist position, they're saying that this sort of subject is abhyakrita. It cannot be spoken about. Non-discussable subject matter. Like, for example, I'll mention some of these 10 points. Whether the universe is limited or unlimited. Can't be talked about. Whether the universe is eternal or temporary. Abhyakrita. Can't discuss that. Whether the soul exists or doesn't exist, can't be discussed. Whether the soul is also eternal or temporary. Abhyakrita. Don't talk about it. So when you consider these 10 points, you realize that actually Buddhism is not a philosophy. If it can't answer these questions, if it just says, sorry, abhyakrita, undiscussable. That's why I think that's the Buddhist ideal, you know, they end up like a Zen Buddhist who just sitting in meditation. They say the founder of Zen Buddhism, Bodhidharma, for 12 years he sat looking at a cave wall. And one, this was in China, he came from India, he was an Indian prince. And he sat in meditation looking at the blank stone wall of a cave. And one Chinese young man came to try to become his disciple, but this Bodhidharma would not respond. The Chinese boy was offering obeisances and begging him, oh great sage, I know you have achieved great enlightenment, you are so austere. He was so austere that because of this meditation, just looking at a blank wall, I mean, what is that? So his eyes got heavy, and would, so then he cut his own eyelids off. So his eyes wouldn't shut anymore, and he just kept staring at the blank wall. And the Chinese boy kept coming for 12 years, again and again, following at the feet of Bodhidharma. Please accept me as your disciple. I want to know this knowledge. And Bodhidharma didn't speak, because that is the knowledge. It is abhyakrita. But you see, there's a fallacy in this, because the boy wanted to be instructed, and that means you have to use words. So finally what he did, according to the story, is the Chinese young man, he cut off his own arm and he laid it in front of his guru, the one he wanted to be his guru. And so Bodhidharma took note of that. All right, oh, you're serious. And I will tell you. But what is there to say? Because the philosophy is abhyakrita. All the important points, they say, can't be talked about. But here, you see, in Bhagavad Gita, no such problem. Krishna says, bhakshami. He does not say avyakrita. He says, vakshami, I am going to speak now. Asheshita. And this subject matter is endless. Like, this is what Srila Prabhupada said. The Mayavadis, the impersonalists, they think when you become realized, then you're like full pot. Like clay pot, full of water. And then if you knock on it, you don't hear much sound because it is full. When the pot is empty, and then you knock on it and there's a resounding hollow sound. So they say, when you're empty, you see, when you have no knowledge, in other words, then you make sounds. Then you talk. Talk so many things. But that talking is just showing you're not enlightened. But when you're enlightened, then you're like full pot, no more sound. You see? So that's their example. But Srila Prabhupada says, for Vaishnavas, Krishna, because Krishna is so wonderful, he is Bhagavan, he is full of all glorious opulences, therefore when we become fully Krishna conscious, we have unlimited subject matter to talk about. And that talking, it is not of this material world. It is called in Srimad Bhagavatam, Vaikuntha Vacha. It is the Vacha, again this word, the Vak, of Vaikuntha, of the spiritual world. The glories of Krishna, which are pure and transcendental. Shabda Brahma, spiritual sound. It is not material, it is not laukika shabda, ordinary sound, which simply binds us to illusion. Like when you turn on the television and you see what they call a talking head, because the camera, you know, is focused on a head. So in your TV box, you'll just see one head there talking to you. Today in Iraq, U.S. Marines found $500 million in gold bullion blah, 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 blah. So, talking head. So all of this kind of, yeah, talking head vacha that you hear on the TV or radio, now this is called laukika. It means ordinary, worldly, phenomenal. It won't do you any ultimate good. You don't really learn anything. You're hearing something, receiving information. But it is not purifying to the heart. So this knowledge, sabhigyanam, the transcendental knowledge, will never be revealed. In fact, the heart is being smothered, is being covered more and more and more and more and more and more by ignorance. Because when one is tuned into this vibration, that means you're accepting this material world as real. One is very eager. But Prabhupada said in the Bhagavad Dharma discourses, which were Prabhupada gave in September 1972, which was for me a very important point in my spiritual life, because I attended each one of these lectures, and that's where I feel that Prabhupada trained me. It wasn't just me, but of course there were hundreds of disciples there, but I was really intently hearing Prabhupada's explanation of this Bhagavad philosophy. So in this Bhagavad Dharma discourse, Srila Prabhupada made this very same point, you see, that seem to have lost my way. What was I talking about before? I was talking about Vaikuntha Vacha. Oh yes, yes, exactly, precisely. So yes, and so Prabhupada said in this Bhagavad Dharma discourse that he said there's an easy way to tell the difference between a materialist and a spiritualist. To just see what they like to read. So, a materialist, he likes to read newspaper. He likes to read news magazines, these kind of things. Mundane subject matter, laukika. Laukika shabda. You see, every morning they get up and they go to the breakfast table and they have to have their big mug of java and their morning newspaper. You see? And what do the devotees do at the same time, 7 o'clock in the morning? They're here in the Bhagavatam class, hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, reading Srimad Bhagavatam. Srila Prabhupada said, there's the clear difference. You want to know who is a materialist and who is a spiritualist? Just see what they read. The devotee, he likes to read the Bhagavatam. He likes to hear Srimad Bhagavatam. The materialist, he, it's not just likes to, he has to read the newspaper. If one morning the newspaper is not there, oh, he's very disturbed. Where's my newspaper? Well, paper boy didn't come yet. What? What the hell is this? What? And he calls up angrily the newspaper office or something. Where's that paper boy? I need my paper. He'll be disturbed the whole rest of the day if he didn't get his fix of mundane katha. He really feels he missed something. You see, it's very interesting. Morning class, you see, it's 7 o'clock in the morning. Because on the Hare Krishna temple, we're also hearing, but we're hearing news of the spiritual world. We're hearing the Srimad Bhagavatam, Vaikuntha Vacha. And 7 o'clock in the morning, in all these apartments and houses, people are reading the news of the world of birth, death, disease, and old age. And they're thinking this is very important, very necessary. Have to know what's going on. Have to keep up to date. You see? Now this is whole two different realms of hearing and chanting. One is purifying the heart of the material disease, and one is piling the heart deeper and deeper and deeper in the stool of material subject matter. Huh? Idam vakshame sheshara. So Krishna says, I'm going to speak on this. And this speaking is purifying. He goes on to say, yaj gyatva neha bhuyo nyaj gyatavyam avashishate. When you hear this from me, then It will bring forth knowledge in your heart, and by this knowledge, nothing further shall remain for you to know. In other words, it will destroy all ignorance. And this is a consistent theme of the Srimad Bhagavad Gita. The utter destruction of all ignorance from the heart of the living entity by the process of hearing. This is the culmination of the Gita. We turn to the 18th chapter. This is how Gita concludes. Bhuya, similar language. Bhuya. Shrinu me, hear from me. Paramam vachaha. Again that word. Vachaha. Shrinu, hear from me. Paramam, the supreme. This is, again, parama means transcendental. It does not mean worldly, laukika. The opposite. Paramam vacha or Vaikuntha vacha. And then ishto si me dudham iti tuto vakshami te hitam. Because you are my very dear friend, I am speaking to you my supreme instruction, the most confidential knowledge of all. Hear this from me, for it is for your benefit. You see? This will do you real good, Krishna is saying. And then he gives this instruction, manmana bhava madbhavto madhyajima, become my devotee. Always think of me, worship me, bow down before me and my servants, become very meek and humble. Sarva dharma prityagya, mamikam sharanam braja, famous. 1866, the whole Charan Shloki of Bhagavad Gita. And in this same section, Krishna says, yes, here he says, in the 58 now, chapter 18, very important point. Machitta sarva durgani mat prasadat tarishase atta chitta mahankaram na shoshushi vinankshushi. So nashashvashi means, if you do not hear from me, if you do not do this hearing, vinankshyasi, you will be destroyed, you will be lost. You see? If you become conscious of me, matchitta, sarva durgani, mat prasadat tadashyasi, you will pass over all the obstacles of conditioned life by my grace. Very significant language. Sarva Durgani. Durga Devi is the mistress of this material world. Durga in Sanskrit literally means prison. Durga. Actually, we have cognates to this this combination of root words in our own languages. Like Dur. Dur in English and many other languages. This prefix dur means something that's very tough, hard, difficult, like duress. A person who is in duress means he's in great difficulty, he's suffering. Or even something is durable, means very hard to break. So dur, it gives the sense of an obstacle that is very, very difficult to go over. And then ga, like we say in English, go. Durga means Durga Devi makes your going difficult. That's how this word Durga is to be translated. Durga Devi, the mistress of the material world, she has imprisoned you here, and therefore it is very, very difficult for you to go anywhere except through the cycle of birth, death, disease, and old age. Again and again and again and again. And so Krishna declares, has already declared earlier in the Bhagavad Gita, mama maya duratyaya, dur again. Mama Maya Duratyaya. My Maya is extremely difficult to overcome. It means there's nothing we can do on our own to get out of this fallen condition. Then he goes on to say, but if you surrender to me, mama maya duratiya, mam evam ye prapadyante, mayamitam tarantite, then you will cross beyond it. Now, this verse, 1858, Krishna is saying basically the same thing, but he's giving additional elaboration. Because the question may be, all right, so Krishna is saying, mam evam ye prapadyante, surrender to me. But how do I go about doing that? What's the specific process? What does Krishna want from me? What does he want me to do? That he will recognize I'm surrendering to him and therefore let me cross beyond his maya, which is otherwise impossible to get over. That is being explained here. Machita, he says, you become conscious of me. You become conscious of me. So this mamevye prapadyante, in other words, not blind surrender. It's not blind surrender. You know, yes, okay, Krishna, I give up. You see, whatever you want, I don't know what you want, but whatever you want. You see, not that. You know, Krishna says, machitta, you become conscious of me. It means you must attain this, what we heard in tonight's verse, sabhijnana. You must attain this realization of my spiritual nature. This is what machitta means. Then, sarva durgani mat prasada tadishasi. Then, mat prasada means by my grace, my mercy. Tadishasi means crossover. Crossover. Like I speak of this. Kali Santarana Upanishad. Kali, the age of Kali. Santa, the saintly persons. Taran, how they will cross over the age of Kali. So Tarishasi, another form of the same word. So by my mercy, Tarishasi, you will cross over what? Sarva Durgani. The entire obstacle, the entire obstacle course of this material existence. Which nobody can get out of on their own. It is so formidable. Sarva Durgani, the whole thing, you will cross over by my grace if you become conscious of me. And how do you become conscious? Then in this word, we in this verse, last line, Shoshishi, you hear. Tat Shunu, Krishna says elsewhere. Shunu me, hear from me, hear from me, again and again. Hear from me, hear from me. Krishna is acting as Arjuna's guru. And this is the essence of that relationship. Guru is not about, you know, simply nice smile. Prabhupada said, used to sarcastically remark about long white beard and big turban. This is the accoutrements of guru for many people, you see. If he has nice saffron cloth and long white beard and a big turban and can smile and be very, very charismatic, then, oh, that's his guru. This is guru, yes. He is my guru. Bhuya, similar language. Bhuya. Shrinu me, hear from me. Paramam vachaha. Again that word. Vachaha. Shnu, hear from me. Paramam, the supreme. This is, again, Paramam means transcendental. It does not mean worldly, laukika. The opposite. Paramam vacha or Vaikuntha vacha. And then ishto si me dudham iti tuto vakshami te hitam. Because you are my very dear friend, I am speaking to you my supreme instruction, the most confidential knowledge of all. Hear this from me, for it is for your benefit. You see? This will do you real good, Krishna is saying. And then he gives this instruction, manmana bhava madbhavto madhyajima, become my devotee. always think of me, worship me, bow down before me, and my servants become very meek and humble. Sarva Dharma Prityaga Mamikam Sharanam Braja, famous. 1866, the whole Charan Shloki of Bhagavad Gita. And in this same section, Krishna says, yes, here he says, in the text 58 of chapter 18, very important point. Machitta sarva durgani mat prasadat tarishase atta chitta mahankaram na shoshushi vinankshushi. So na shoshushi means if you do not hear from me, if you do not do this hearing, vinankshushi, you will be destroyed, you will be lost. You see? If you become conscious of me, machitta sarva durgani mat prasadat tadashisi, you will pass over all the obstacles of conditioned life by my grace. Very significant language. Sarva durgani, Durga Devi, is the mistress of this material world. Durga in Sanskrit literally means prison. Durga. Actually, we have cognates to this this combination of root words in our own languages. Like dur. Dur in English and many other languages. This prefix dur means something that's very tough, hard, difficult. Like dures. A person who is in dures means he's in great difficulty. He's suffering. Or even something is durable, means very hard to break. So dur. Dur. It gives the sense of an obstacle that is very, very difficult to go over. And then ga, like we say in English, go. Durga means Durga Devi makes your going difficult. That's how this word Durga is to be translated. Durga Devi, the mistress of the material world, she has imprisoned you here, and therefore it is very, very difficult for you to go anywhere except through the cycle of birth, death, disease, and old age, again and again and again and again. And so Krishna declares, has already declared earlier in the Bhagavad Gita, mama maya duratyaya, dur again. Mama maya duratyaya, my maya is extremely difficult to overcome. It means there's nothing we can do on our own to get out of this fallen condition. Then he goes on to say, but if you surrender to me, mama maya duratyaya, mam evam ye prapadyante mayamitam tarantite, then you will cross beyond it. Now this verse, 1858, Krishna is saying basically the same thing, but he's giving additional elaboration, because the question may be, alright, so Krishna is saying mam evam ye prapadyante, surrender to me, but how do I go about doing that? What's the specific process? What does Krishna want from me? What does he want me to do? That he will recognize I'm surrendering to him, and therefore let me cross beyond his maya, which is otherwise impossible to get over. That is being explained here. Machitta, he says, you become conscious of me. You become conscious of me. So this mamevye prapadyante, in other words, not blind surrender. It's not blind surrender. You know, oh yes, okay Krishna, I give up. You see, whatever you want, I don't know what you want, but whatever you want. You see, not that. You know, Krishna says, machitta, you become conscious of me. It means you must attain this, what we heard in tonight's verse, sabhijnana, You must attain this realization of my spiritual nature. This is what matchitta means. Then sarva durgani mat prasada tadishasi. Then mat prasada means by my grace, my mercy. Tarishasi means crossover. Crossover. Like I speak of this. Kali Santarana Upanishad. Kali, the age of Kali. Santa, the saintly persons. Taran, how they will cross over the age of Kali. So Tarishasi, another form of the same word. So by my mercy, Tarishasi, you will cross over what? Sarva Durgani. The entire obstacle, the entire obstacle course of this material existence, which nobody can get out of on their own. It is so formidable. Sarva Durgani, the whole thing, you will cross over by my grace if you become conscious of me. And how do you become conscious? Then in this word, we in this verse, last line, shoshashi, you hear. Tat shunu, Krishna says elsewhere. Shunu me, hear from me, hear from me, again and again. Hear from me, hear from me. Krishna is acting as Arjuna's guru. And this is the essence of that relationship. Guru is not about, simply nice smile. Prabhupada said, used to sarcastically remark about long white beard and big turban. This is the accoutrements of guru for many people, you see. If he has nice saffron cloth and long white beard and a big turban and can smile and be very, very charismatic, then, that's his guru. This is guru, yes. He is my guru. He opens his mouth. He reveals himself to be a fool, talking all nonsense. Saying, I am God, you are God. But I know that I'm God and you don't, so therefore you have to worship me. And eventually you will become God, but not as long as I'm around. As long as I'm here, you can't be God. I'm God. So... worship me. Some idiot philosophy like that they speak. So this is nonsense. We shouldn't hear that. But Krishna says, Shoshashi, hear from me this knowledge. Hear from me this knowledge. And then you'll machitta, become conscious of me. It's by the hearing process. But in this verse, the warning is given. Atichatvam ahankara nash shoshashi vinankshasi. If you do not hear from me, then you will be captured by ahamkara, false ego. In other words, you will, because the issue here in Bhagavad Gita is Arjuna's fighting. And this is explained in the next verse also, text 59 further. Krishna says, because your nature, you are Kshatriya. So you will fight. You are now. You have been telling me, I shall not fight, but your nature will overcome you, and you will fight. If not here, you will fight elsewhere. But because you have refused to accept what I am teaching here today, this Bhagavad Gita, then your fighting, your activity will all be under ahamkara, false ego. You will be thinking you are the doer. And the penalty for thinking I am the doer, you see, it's a very logical and just penalty. No one can protest. If I perform activities in this world on my own volition, in other words, I'm doing them for me. I want certain things, so. I am acting, I am thinking, I am the doer, I am in this conception, I will do this and attain that. Then Durga, the Maya Shakti, she says, very nice, very fine. You are the doer, so I will make you responsible for all your activities. That's what you want. You claim to be the doer. Then you will have to pick up the tab. You know, as they say, pick up the tab. You know, you go into a restaurant, you order a big meal, and then the waiter comes at the end with the tab. And if you're there with guests, then, you know, generally one person, if he wants to prove something to the others, he'll say, I'll pick up the tab, I'll pay for everything. And so that's what happens to the living entity. Maya Devi comes with a big tab. And she goes into infinite detail. So you, dear Jiva, you proclaimed yourself the doer. You say you are Karta. Yes, I am Karta. Yes, I am the actor. All right. So now we have a bill here. You, taking responsibility for all your activities, when you were on such and such date, walking down the street to go to the grocery store to buy these goods for your pantry, you, with every step, you crushed the life out of 33,423,568,321 living entities. And this was on July 21st, 1992, at 1:30 p.m. in the afternoon. Then at 1:31 p.m., and so in this way, every single thing that we do, she holds us accountable for. And how are you going to pay this tab? You cannot. Therefore, what happens when you run up a bill and you can't pay it, then you're subject to punishment. You see? So the punishment is all under the law of karma. You can't pay such a bill, so you have to take birth again. And all those living entities that suffered on your account, because you were thinking you were the big doer, in charge of everything and everyone, this is your world, you're the master. All those living entities that suffered, then they get a chance to take their revenge. They get a chance to do harm to you, and this is the way it goes. And you can immediately, when you think of this, just for a few seconds, then you can understand why the jiva who thinks he's the doer is nityabadi, eternally bound up. There's no end to it. Just in this one human life, just in one day of a human life, one accumulates so much karma that the births could not be counted, that one has to take to pay back all this transgression of laws of nature and doing harm to other creatures in one 24-hour period. That is already birth for far beyond our power to understand. So many births. What to speak of a whole lifetime? Day in, day out. You see? Because acting on one's own account means acting for sense gratification. And acting for sense gratification means I think I'm the enjoyer. And what am I enjoying? I'm enjoying the lives of others. I'm enjoying other living entities. You see? Walking down the street, one sees a nice flower, plop, pull it out of the ground. Ah, oh, very nice smell, throw it away. You see? This is the attitude. Oh, you just took the life of a flower. You're responsible. Maya will come with her tabulation. Every breath of air we take, every breath of air we're breathing. And so many living entities are going into our nose and getting caught in the nose hairs and dying there. See, every time we chew anything, even if we're vegetarian, there's so many little microbes, living entities on the apple or whatever, and we're eating them too. Thinking, I'm vegetarian, I'm practicing ahimsa. But every bite is a holocaust. So, this is what Krishna is saying. Na shoshasi. If you do not hear from me, if you do not hear how to get out of this world, as I am telling you, minankshasi, then you will be lost. Huh? Acting under false ego, thinking I am the doer. So we have to give up. We have to give up this. This is the misconception that the living entity has to be purified of, that I am the doer. Even these jnanis are still thinking the same thing, to get back to my original point. When they're doing this neti, 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 it is simply out of frustration that I have tried to enjoy this material world and I only suffered. So now let me get myself out. They're still thinking I'm the doer. You see? Now let me, by my own, you know, superior intellect and vast learning of Upanishad, Vedanta, let me get myself out of Maya. Now you still think you're the doer. You're still an illusion. And that means you'll go nowhere. You'll just remain in this material world. So this is the meaning of surrender to me. It must be in knowledge. So we can only surrender to Krishna if we know our constitutional position is part and parcel of Krishna. We are part and parcel of Krishna's spiritual energy. That is what we are. Krishna says we belong. He says, prakriti vidhi me param. You have to know my superior, para prakriti. And that is the living entity. This is again what he's talking about. Jnanam teyaham sabhijnanam. There is this material world and there is the spiritual world. And you, jiva, belong to the spiritual world. And this is what you have to know. We are thinking we are the doer and all this nonsense, enjoyer, because we think we belong to the material world. We think we are this body. We think we are this mind. We think we belong here. This is my home. This is our big mistake. And therefore we become addicted. Simply addicted to this path of birth and death. Addicted to mundane activity, addicted to mundane knowledge, addicted to all mundane conceptions, even such conceptions of spiritual life, mundane conceptions of spiritual life, mundane religion, mundane everything. Maya addicts. So therefore Krishna is proclaiming this transcendental knowledge that he is teaching. This is the means of ridding ourselves of that addiction, of that attraction. Param drishtva, higher taste. It is to be gained by this hearing process. Alright, so we will stop here. Thank you very much. Would there be any question at this time? Yes?
Describe this noumenal reflex to the phenomenal. Does it mean that the substance of the spiritual world becomes reflected and then becomes substance here? Or does it mean that the qualities are only reflected? Or is it that the substance are totally different than the spiritual substance is transforming into the material substance?
Well, the Lord's energy, His Shakti, is ultimately one. There is only one substance. But that is for Him, that is for Krishna. That is for Him to understand. That is for Him, that substance is for Him to manipulate. We are the Lord's energy. We are His marginal energy. So we are not in a position to understand the Lord's energy in that way. We're simply not in a position. Oh, well, theoretically we cannot. We have the examples Prabhupada gave us of electricity. It is one thing, but in an electric oven, it heats. In an electric refrigerator, or freezer, it freezes.
So one is broiling things, making things very hot, and another is making things very cold, but same energy. So we can understand that way, but practically speaking, in our life, here is this material nature. It is also called in Bhagavad Gita, 14th chapter, Brahma, Mahad Brahma, it is called. It is the Lord's energy. But it is acting against us. It is we belong to the Lord's spiritual nature. Mama Aivangsa Jiva Loke Jiva Bhutta Sanatana. That is us. We are Sanatana. We are eternal. But this material energy, which in essence is also eternal, in its ultimate essence, but how is it acting? It is acting, going through cycles and cycles of Srishti Stiti Pralaya, creation, maintenance, destruction, and recreation, again and again and again and again and again. Mahavishnu breathing out, breathing in, breathing out, cosmic manifestation, and cosmic destruction, manifestation again, destruction. So, this is Krishna's energy, but it is acting as his inferior separated energy. This is why, ultimately, this Krishna's energy is personified. Is a person. Who is that person? When we speak of the original one, Adya Shakti, original energy, that is Srimati Radharani. But just as Krishna, he's one, Eko Deva Nityanila Nirukto Bhakta Vyaprihridarantaratma, God Eko Deva is one, but he has unlimited devotees, and he has an individual personal relationship with every one of the devotees. Although he is one. Now that is not possible if we take God's oneness in any ordinary sense, that he is one isolated individual. How can one, you see, one person, he cannot find time to have relationship with even 20 or 50 or 100 people in a day. It's very difficult. What to speak of? I mean, you cannot count the number of devotees in Vaikuntha Dham. So if we take this stereotype conception of oneness as meaning there is one Krishna in Goloka Vrindavan, that's it. Now we know Krishna expands. Krishna expands in the Rasa Lila, there's Krishna next to every gopi. Not only that, for devotees in other rasas, other bhavas, he expands in other rupas. Therefore, Lord Ramchandra is there. Therefore, Lord Narsingadev is there. Therefore, Lord Narayan is there. So many Narayan forms. All of them are Krishna. And similarly, Srimati Radharani, the Adya Shakti. He is Adi Purush. She is Adya Shakti. But she has expanded. So many gopis and so many Lakshmis. And finally, she is also Durga too. But Durga, as a Gaudiya Vaishnava philosophy, Gaudiya Vaishnava Granta, Goswami Granta, the writings of the Goswamis tell us, Durga Devi is 1 millionth of 1 millionth of a part of Radharani's potency. We separate from Radharani 1 millionth of her potency, and then from that 1 millionth, you divide that into 1 million parts and take one of that, and then you have Durga. And Durga is considered, you see, there's this class of religionists in India called the Shaktas, and they consider her all-powerful. But she's only 1 millionth of 1 millionth part of Radharani. They consider her all-powerful, yes, because she has, although being fragmental expansion, amsa of Radharani, she has sufficient power to keep all the wayward non-devotee jivas under her tight control, total control. So this is, Prabhupada said, Durga is, or Mahamaya, is another phase. I think I explained this The way Prabhupada said it when he initiated one of his disciples, Mahamaya Devi Dasi. You could say he said face or face of Radharani. Face, meaning just like Krishna's Vishwarup, you see so many faces coming out. Finally, your face is also there somewhere. That doesn't mean you are Krishna, but you are expanded from the original person. And Srimati Radharani also. So one of her faces is that of Durga, Kali Ma, the Shakti of the material world. Just like Krishna also, Natyadar, his name is Natyadar, the great actor, the greatest actor. So, who is Lord Shiva? This is Krishna in a role. Mahadev, Lord Shiva. This is Krishna, but in a particular role. So you see, the actor has always so much more versatility than any particular role that he plays. Those who are, you know, staunch Hindus, who have taken this, you know, been bitten by this Mayavadi philosophy, poison, they object when we say Krishna is the original person, Shiva is, like Bhagavatam says, Vaishnavanam Yata Shambhu, Lord Shiva Shambhu, he is a Vaishnava, he is a devotee of Krishna. They don't like this. They either want to say Shiva is supreme, or they want to hear that Shiva, Krishna, Durga, all these gods, all are the same, all equal. And you can worship anyone, makes no difference. But no, Krishna is the Natyadar, he's the original actor. So yes, we will agree. We can say, because Brahma Samhita says that Shambhu is a form of Krishna. So in that sense, they are the same. But it's just like an actor, a great thespian, it's a fancy word for actor. He can play so many roles. Some actors are very, very versatile. They're amazing in their versatility. So in one movie or stage play, they'll play handsome young man, dashing hero, but then in another one they'll play a very bad man, evil, just the opposite. And then in another they'll play a very old man, although he's a young man, you see. So he's showing his versatility. So the original actor always has so much more versatility than any specific character he plays. Because when he's in character, then he's locked into this one role. Now he's the dashing young hero. Play some actors, some there've been some recent films where a male actor plays a female, a woman. You see, I remember years ago, Dustin Hoffman. He played in such a movie. He dressed up like a woman. He was acting like a woman so perfectly. So you know, they're so versatile. The original actor, so many roles come out. So this is Krishna, and this is also Radharani. So Radharani, for her pleasure, she assumes the role of Durga. You see? Radharani is such a nice, chaste, all perfect, the perfect image of divine woman. But sometimes she puts on all black makeup and puts a third eye. Has long crazy hair and a garland of skulls and really lets it all go. 10 arms. You see? Or all of that is within her, you see, and manifests. And this is God. Everything comes from God. Aham Savasya Prabhu. So Durga is a face or a phase, like the phase of the moon. Purnima, Amavasya. Purnima is Radharani, Amavasya is Kali. God is Kali. So the Shakti is one that we can understand philosophically, but because we are Jiva, we are so small, we are marginal, in between. Marginal means we are Tatastha, in between. Therefore we cannot just you know, well, all is one. Krishna's energy is one. There's no difference between material energy and spirit. We're not in the position to say that. We have to make distinction. If we do not, then we will become offenders and fall down. So therefore there is this knowledge. This knowledge that Krishna is giving is so that we can distinguish. So it is, the answer to your question is, Krishna's energy is one, but it is so powerful and so wonderful, so inconceivable, therefore it is called Achincha Shakti, that this one energy acts in different ways. So it is acting as the spiritual manifestation and also as the material manifestation. And this is all going on under Krishna's order, Krishna's will. Anything else? Yes?
We're talking about that Socrates and Plato were extolling Vedic ideas, like the world over ideas.
But to some degree, yeah, they had some.
But can we also say that anything that is useful to serve, in service of Krishna doesn't necessarily have to come from India, of course, like the harmonium is from France, and then it's more like an amalgam of parts of different cultures.
But where does everything come from? Does it come from India or come from Krishna?
But my point is that the devotees are so fixed on saying everything comes from India, India is beautiful, India is perfect, India is, right? But it doesn't depend on where it comes from, rather it depends on whether it's useful in service of Krishna. So the Greeks, maybe it was a Vedic idea, maybe it wasn't, maybe it was their own creation.
But you can't prove that. You're just talking.
Can you prove that it was Vedic?
Well, the Greek language is definitely connected to Sanskrit. Mm-hmm. And Sanskrit is older than Greek. That's accepted. So therefore the linguists themselves have set up this, what they call the Indo-European family of languages. And of these languages, Sanskrit is the oldest. And what do languages convey? They convey ideas. Mm-hmm. So when you see, even in the New Testament, in the Greek New Testament, which is translated into English, it talks about the glorified body, when that Christ, for example, after his crucifixion, came back for 40 days and revealed what is termed a glorified body. And it is promised to the faithful Christians that they will also attain such a glorified body. So in the Greek language, the word for glorified body is pneuma somatica, something like, yes, pneuma somatica. So pneuma, actually, just like we have the word pneumatic tire, it refers to air. So it is equivalent of the Sanskrit prana, pneuma, prana, and soma is equivalent to sharira. So prana sharira. That means a subtle body. So we see the language is similar and the concepts are similar. There is a definite relationship. And there is even historical evidence. It is thought that one of the Neoplatonists named Plotinus, that he had inherited this knowledge of Plato and he wanted to become perfect in it. He wanted to perfect this Platonic philosophy. He was after Plato. So he tried to go to India. He didn't make it, so he accepted a teacher who was in Alexandria in Egypt, named Sakkasimonius, I think. And it is said that he was from India. He was an Indian who had come to live in Egypt. So he couldn't, Plotinus couldn't make it to India because he wanted to get the full, you know, the full complete knowledge that Plato had, you know, also derived his philosophy from. So his goal was to go to India. And when he couldn't, he accepted an Indian guru in Egypt and learned from him. That's history. These are things I found, not in BBT books, but just, you know, history books.
And I can make another objection to name some idea from history, like that the power in a state should be divided into three parts, the three-party political something. This was a French idea, in fact, right? Power should be shared. It's not from India, but it works. It has been working in the West for centuries now. And although it's not perfect, it's the best of you know, it's the best we can get. And also, democracy is not a Vedic idea. It's from the Greeks. So all these beautiful concepts, they spring not from India.
So what are you trying to say by this?
Well,
because, you know,